Welcome back to the U.S. Naval History Podcast. We pick up the story as the Massachusetts Militia and the largest fleet of American ships assembled during the Revolutionary War have just snuck into Penobscot Bay, where the British under General McLean are building a fort. The American goal is to destroy this fort before the British can finish their fort and become entrenched. For more background on this, you can go listen to parts 1 and 2 of this Penobscot Expedition miniseries. So early in the morning of July 24th, 1779, the Americans have arrived in Penobscot Bay. As the fog clears, General McLean, he begins to receive word that the Americans are in Penobscot Bay. But the slowly moving fleet is not yet in sight of his quarter-finished fort. But quarter-finished or not, it seems that time is up, and General McLean is going to have to go into battle with what he had right now. And from here, I want to make a somewhat weird proposal, but over the next couple days of the initial assault, it can be thought of almost in board game terms. This is not a modern battle with fast communications, no shock and awe, reinforcements are not going to come flying over the horizon. Neither side has any reinforcements coming in the near term, and they're going to have to fight it out with what they have on the scene. Decisions get made at commanders' conferences, which means that as soon as one side makes a tactical move, all the opposite side's commanders walk, or in the case of the Navy, row small boats to a central location. They discuss how to respond, and then they walk slash row their small boats back to their respective units. And then they give orders, which their units respond to. And these units, they move very slowly because, again, we're in the age of walking slash rowing slash sailing to make a counter. The enemy then responds to this response, and the cycle goes on. Each side trying to position themselves in a way that will force the enemy to realize that they have been outmaneuvered in retreat, or even better, to outmaneuver the enemy without the enemy realizing they have been outmaneuvered, which would allow you to defeat the enemy in a pitched battle. And on the first American turn, so to speak, we spend it gathering some local intelligence. Officers were sent ashore and basically start knocking on doors in the area, looking for some patriotic revolutionaries who can give them an idea of what was going on with that British fort. And so despite the delays in getting the expedition underway, the intelligence gathered revealed that the British fort was still largely in the early stages of construction, so that's good. This meant that taking it would be much easier. General Lavelle, who commanded the ground forces for the Americans, was also approached by the Penobscot Indians, who offered their assistance against the British, which Lavelle accepted. And so finally, on the afternoon of the 24th, the American fleet arrives within sight of the British fort, and they anchored for the night. The British, for their part, they recalled all the sailors working ashore to construct the fort back to the ships to prepare for a possible clash the next morning and kept a close watch on the American fleet, which resembled, quote, a floating island where the masts were a forest of trees. At 7 a.m. sharp the next morning, Commodore Saltonstall, who commanded the American fleet, assembled his ships. On the north side of the harbor, and at the peak of the hill on the Bragadoose Peninsula, stood the British fort with the British flag flapping in the wind atop a tent pole. Below were two smaller batteries also being constructed, guarding the harbor's mouth, and a third battery to the south on a small island called Banks Island. Three anchored British sloops with broadsides pointed towards the line of attack sat across the entrance to this small harbor that the British were guarding. If you're looking for a map at this point, you can find one at usnavalhistory.com, where I made a video using Google Earth, zooming in on a satellite view of where everything was happening. You can also find a lot of extra content related to this podcast. There's a link in the show notes for this episode. So back in 1779, Commodore Saltonstall sends a ship to investigate and came back with a similar report that the British fort was far from complete. The Americans would seem to have the advantage if they struck now. But Commodore Saltonstall did not press the immediate attack, despite the eagerness of some of his subordinate captains. He was far too experienced for that. He was extremely highly regarded in the Continental Navy at the time. The huge tides and the strong currents of the Penobscot Bay made navigation tricky, and also made it pretty variable with time of day. And because of the bay's geography, it blocked a lot of the wind, meant that ships' oars would often have to be used to very slowly move against the current. And here I'm going to quote from Georgie Bucher's book, The Penobscot Expedition, because I think it offers a good tactical summary of the problem facing Saltonstall when commanding any assault against the British position. The British defensive position employed the ideal offensive formation of crossing the T. And here's a quick aside for anyone who does not know what that is. I have a great illustration on the website post about this, but basically, crossing the T is a naval warfare tactic in the Age of Sail and then all the way through the battleship era, where one ship or group of ships usually was able to cross in front of the opponent's ship at a perpendicular angle, forming a capital T shape. And that allowed the crossing ship the ability to fire a broadside, meaning all the guns on one side of the ship, down the entire length of the enemy vessel, meaning that you can bring all of your guns to bear against the enemy. Meanwhile, the enemy can only bring their forward guns to shoot at you, giving the ship able to fire their broadside a significant firepower advantage. In this case, the British ships were anchored and thus would not have to sail across. But the American ships, in order to engage, would have to very slowly approach against the full firepower of the three British ships while only being able to fire the forward guns. Okay, back to Bucher's description. Quote, the British had the added benefit of not being underway or depending on the wind and seamanship to keep that position. First, Saltonstall would have to wait for favorable wind and tide. Then, while he could only engage his bow guns, he'd have to advance directly into the broadside of all the British ships. If the lead ship became disabled, it endangered his remaining ships in the restricted sea room. Besides the British ships, Saltonstall also had the fort on the eminence, two batteries below the fort, and a third on Banks Island opposing him. Finally, in a sudden calm, not at all uncommon in the area, could place the Commodore's vessels in a crisis. And so what Commodore Saltonstall did instead of charging directly into the teeth of the British fleet was advance opposite Ragadoose Island to where the British fort lay. And they remained just out of gun range. The unarmed transport ships carrying all the soldiers were kept safely away from the British. And then Commodore Saltonstall climbed down from his 32-gun flagship, the Warren, and onto a small schooner to sail around to his other warships and issue them instructions. This process took several hours, and now you see what I mean by this resembling a strategy board game of sort with very deliberate moves by each team. And so under Commodore Saltonstall's orders, a few American ships were sent out for a probing attack against the British. Five ships made a dash for British lines, and then made a quick turn right at the ship's mutual cannon range. They unloaded broadsides at each other, and the American column quickly turned out a further British gunshot range. This basically let each side get one full broadside, but didn't allow the British to pummel the American ships in a crossing the T formation. Because these are the sorts of tactics that you have to use against an anchored force instead of charging directly to the top of the T. And there's actually some pretty significant differences in various historical accounts of this first skirmish, but everyone agrees that the dash and run cannon exchanges did little damage to either side. However, for Commodore Saltonstall, breaking the British line was never the point. The point was to keep the British busy. Because while the ships were exchanging fire, General Lavelle began loading the Massachusetts militiamen from their transport boats into small boats for a landing. With the Massachusetts militia loaded into small boats, they began to row for Dice's Point on Bragadoose, which is the very southern point of that peninsula. This was the beachhead from which the main assault would then take place. Well, in theory. As it turned out, as the first wave of small boats approached Dice's Point, General Lavelle, through his telescope, judged that the winds were too high, which might delay a second wave of landing soldiers, which in turn would leave the first wave undermanned and vulnerable to a British counterattack. And so with the first wave of small boats very close to shore, General Lavelle ordered the signal for the small boats to pull back under sporadic fire from the British on Bragadoose, who are now well aware of the American plan. Surprise was spoiled for that night, but Commodore Saltonstall was not done. Throughout the night, he planned and issued orders, and at 4 a.m. he issued his final orders for the next landing attempt to be covered by two American warships. In the dark, General Lavelle again loaded his men onto small boats. At daybreak, sent his men off to the designated landing point at Bragadoose in the morning calm before the winds picked up as usual in late morning. And here you can sort of see the problem. In the morning, there aren't a lot of winds, which is great for sending small boats, which chop affects a lot. But that also means that the bigger warships aren't effective because they need wind to move. And so sort of a tactical dilemma here. And so this time, though, the second wave, there was no surprise. And in the words of Captain Mowat, who commanded the British naval element, quote, "At the break of day, the enemy attempted to make good their landing at the same place as before and were again repulsed," end quote. The American landing attempts were now 0-2. General Lavelle was not happy about this turn of events, to say the least. The assault was not going well, and based on intel reports from a local militiaman who had helpfully been volunteering to help build the British fort just 2 days ago before mustering for duty when the American fleet arrived, General Lavelle believed that if the force of American ships just committed to sailing closer to the landing site, they could easily outgun the land-based cannon and cover a landing, which would then allow the land assault to succeed against the numerically inferior British. And to this suggestion from General Lavelle, Commodore Salton Salt issued his famous-ish line, quote, "You seem to be damn knowing of this whole matter. I am not going to risk my ship in that damn hole," end quote. And that was that. Because there was no unified commander of the expedition, if Commodore Salton Salt was not willing to risk his ships and what he considered a bad maneuver, there was not a darn thing that General Lavelle could do about it. Among many other things, this line would haunt Commodore Salton Salt in a court-martial after the expedition, quite literally, went up in flames. He would be accused of incompetence and cowardice and a lot more. But in reality, for a lot of technical reasons I'm not going to get into that have to deal with square-rigged ships and wind angles, etc., Commodore Salton Salt was very right to be worried about what would happen once he sent his ships into what he described as that damn hole, aka close enough to shore to fully engage the British ships, fort, and to cover the landing. His ships, because again, the square rigging, the wind angles, yada yada, would be effectively stuck until the wind shifted considerably, or the ebb current was strong enough to push his ships back out of enemy cannon range. And so basically, his assault, unless it worked perfectly, his ships would be sitting ducks and could be destroyed with no ability to maneuver. And maybe this is the sort of high-stakes gamble that a unified commander could approve, but there was no unified command. And furthermore, why was a high-stakes gamble really needed? The Americans outnumbered and outgunned the British by a huge margin. But General Lavelle didn't see it this way. He almost certainly did not actually understand the naval considerations. All he knew is that he looked like a fool after two failed assaults, and he felt that he was not getting the support he wanted from his naval counterpart. And so a council of war was called. And at this council of war, a new plan was decided upon. First, a marine detachment would command a landing force to capture the nearby Banks Island with its small British garrison, with the support of three warships. To distract the British from this landing on Banks Island, the rest of the warships would make a feint towards the harbor that the British were defending, with General Lavelle's troops again embarking very visibly on small boats as if they were going to make a third landing at that same dice point on Bragadus. And then, only after Commodore Salton Salt's marines captured Banks Island, and the British could no longer use that island as a firing point to defend Bragadus, General Lavelle's soldiers would change their apparent landing point and land for real just opposite Banks Island on the Bragadus Peninsula. And in the beginning, the plan worked. 200 Marines and artillerymen disembarked on Banks Island and quickly occupied it. Meanwhile, just like the plan dictated, Commodore Salton Salt's ships lined up for a fake attack in support of General Lavelle's third landing. With Banks Island captured by the Marines, the path was now clear for the new landing site. Small boats turned and made their way to the now relatively undefended landing site opposite Banks Island. However, then the British got unlucky and the American landing force lost its nerve. A lucky British cannonball hit the lead boat of the landing, overturning it. Major Littlefield, who was leading this assault, drowned, and in the words of one American ship captain, quote, "The plan of the militia was put a stop to," end quote. And obviously, I was not there, but I think that this indicates a pretty severe lack of command structure if the man leading the assault's death cancels the whole operation. But nonetheless, that is what happened, and for the third time in 3 days, the Massachusetts militia had failed to land at their assigned spot. Here's what Captain Mowat, again, the British naval commander, wrote. "These 3 or 4 days of embarrassment on the part of the rebels gave our troops time to do something more to the fort, to carry up the most necessary stores, to mount several guns, and in short, to devote every endeavor to the present exigency." And here's Bucher. Meanwhile, the Marines on Banks Island quickly reached the summit, where they began building their own breastwork. Their works faced eastward towards the British ship. That evening, General Lavelle ordered Colonel Revere, yes, that Paul Revere, to send more officers and men with 2 18-pounders, 1 12-pounder, and howitzer to the island. Soon, sailors and militia joined the Marines. All hands worked industriously through the night on their breastwork. Philbrook said they made as little noise as possible so the British ships would not hear them and guess their purpose. In spite of their attempt to be quiet, Mouett realized the American ships were changing the battery's orientation to engage his troops. He ordered the King's ships to slip their anchors and fall back to a second station and align as before. Captain Mouett's second position, while it still defended the harbor, no longer threatened American landings at Bragadoose Bluff. By dawn, the new American battery was ready. And this is where I'm going to leave this episode. The American force had been rebuffed. The British bought some valuable time to keep building fortifications. But the Americans were now in a stronger tactical position to assault the Bragadoose Peninsula, where the main British force was. The game continues. So real quick, there is a new subscription option for the podcast if you want to support the show. You can find it on the new website at usnavalhistory.com. But if you want to support the show in a way other than financially, you can give it a rating. You can tell your friends. You can shoot me an email at usnavalhistory@gmail.com. If you use Apple Podcasts, you can also save me from my most recent review, which is negative, stating that my podcast used to get 5 stars, but apparently now only deserves 3 because I, quote, support sending billions to Ukraine while Americans are homeless and go hungry on the streets, end quote. Okay, this is a gross mischaracterization of what I said in one podcast episode. Aid for Ukraine and helping the homeless are actually not linked issues, but supporting Ukraine is very much in the national security of the United States. You can listen to a much fuller explanation in my episode from November titled The Geopolitics of Ukraine Aid. So if you use Apple Podcasts and are able to give me a review, I'd appreciate it. It'll replace the current most recent review. You'll have the option to do a little review write-up on Apple Podcasts, so write something nice, and you'll make my day. Until next time, fair winds and following seas.